Okay, good to talk. So, what I want to do this week is maybe, yes, another couple of weeks to continue on what we'll call Sugyos in Tanakh. So, this week I want to back up a little bit and actually, if you will, approach the untouchable and talk a little bit about Moshe Rabbeinu. I have to realize that even bringing up the name should make our hearts beat stronger. When I say that we're talking about the untouchable, I'll illustrate this from two angles, why we have to mamash realize that we're approaching Kodesh HaKadoshim. Obviously, and we still have to internalize that even more, I'll just tell you two things that I heard. One time I heard a symposium with Reb Shimshon Pinkus. And the another Rav who was there was talking about the value of life, what you can accomplish in a moment of life. And the example that he gave was, he said, Moshe Rabbeinu is in the Shemayim in a place that's beyond our imagination. And yet, me here on earth, I am in position to give a dollar to tzedakah le'ili nishmas Moshe ben Amram and to enhance his existence, kiviyachol, that much more. And then he turned to Reb Shimshon Pinkus and he said, "What do you say?" And Reb Shimshon Pinkus got up and said, "Absolutely not. We don't do things with Ilui Nishmas Moshe Rabbeinu. We're not busy with trying to enhance his position in Olam Haba. He is above and beyond touch." And along similar lines, again, I can't explain this exactly. Apparently, we're talking, in the realms that are beyond us, but my brother made a bris. It was actually the Yotzeit of Moshe Rabbeinu. It was actually on Zayin Adar. And the Moyel was a very choshev Talmud Chacham. He asked before him, "What's the name?" It happened to be that my brother was naming him Moshe, not after Moshe. He was naming him after a grandfather. So he told the Moyel the name, and the Moyel said, "I hope you're not naming me after Moshe Rabbeinu. We don't name after Moshe Rabbeinu. Where did the name Moshe make it in? I don't know," meaning if we don't do that. But it was kind of like we leave, it's just untouchable. It's just above, beyond, and untouchable. And again, I can't explain it. These are things that are beyond me, but I'm trying to bring out the awe and even the trepidation with which we approach the whole subject.
Name after Avraham Avinu, after Yitzhak, after Yaakov.
Yes, that's part of what I meant when I said that I can't explain it.
Oh.
I don't know. I'm just giving over a certain sense that emerges from these different anecdotes, even though I can't tell you the basis for them. I don't know. What's that? Even Malachim, we have names for, right? So maybe if someone researches the subject, they'll see that it's from a completely, for other different reasons. I don't know. But this is the sense that we should be approaching the subject with. Now, the truth is, it's hard. It really is hard to try to learn about Moshe Rabbeinu. In the Torah, and this is part of the godless of Moshe Rabbeinu, you don't see much about his life prior to his appearance. He was 80 years old. What was his growth process? You see very, very little about that. And once he appears on the scene, he's basically playing the role of the mouthpiece of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the mouthpiece of Hashem. There's very little that you see about Moshe himself, except few things that will touch him, but I want to say here that even what we're going to be touching on, it's as we say, lefi erkein, meaning things that we are capable of perceiving from a distance, taking them in according to our level, with the understanding that we're dealing with things that are way above our heads. So if we'll just start with what we already said, right? Perhaps one of the main things that I don't want to use any hagdaras, actually. I don't want to actually give adjectives. Just want to say, what do we actually see? Moshe is the conveyor, the chief conveyor of the word of Hashem. Toras Moshe, the Torah is called Toras Moshe. The term used in Chazal is Shechina medaberes mitoich groin, that the Shechina spoke through the mouth of Moshe. In that sense, the Midah that we're talking about is the Midah that we saw last week. Anav Mikol Adam. That was the Midah that through which he served as the conveyor of the word of Hashem. Why? Why? Because as the conveyor of the word of Hashem, he had to excel in being transparent. That there wasn't Moshe here. There wasn't Moshe here. There's only the word of Hashem. Complete negation of self, complete negation of his own ego. All he was mamish, just a conduit of the word of Hashem. And this is really what's behind. We say Moshe Rabbeinu was the Anav Mikol Adam Asher Al Pnei Adam. That he was the one who reached. The Chaim V'lajna brings it out this way. He says, Moshe Rabbeinu says, Nachnu Ma, right? When he's facing off against Korach and his people, he says, we just look at Pesukim simply. It's like, what are we? Like, why are you coming to Titus against us? Take him to Hashem. But Chaim V'lajna says he was actually expressing his Madrega. Nachnu Ma, what are we? You're looking at me, there's nothing here. There's nothing here. This is brought out by the Medrash, which Chazal say that some of the great Anavim in history. You have David HaMelech who called himself Anoichi Toila'as V'loi Ish. I'm a worm, not a man. And then you have Avraham Avinu who said Anoichi Ofer Ve'efer. I'm just dirt. He said, but the highest Madrega was Moshe Rabbeinu who said Benachnu Ma. What do you see here? There's nothing here. And it's interesting how Reb Chaim V'lajner he goes further and says, even though he said it about himself and Aaron, it was almost like. Really, nobody else actually reached that Madrega of being nothing. But I want to bring out what that quite means. Not what that quite means. What we can try to perceive of it. What is the idea of talking about all this, Bichlal? Let me just say in parentheses. Why should we be talking about things that are way over our heads? The answer to that is that, first of all, yes, by exposing ourselves to these things, we may get sprayed by some of the. By some of the mist. And that's number one why we expose ourselves. But another reason is that we want to be aware of what we're a part of. We want to be aware. If you just move through Yiddishkeit feeling like there are people, we're people, it's all basically the same, you're missing out on the grandeur, about the magnificence of the system that you're in. In fact, of the life that you're living. The more we can appreciate how above and beyond the human beings that we're working off were, the more of an appreciation we can have for the system that we're in, for being a part of this unbelievable entity called Klal Yisrael. So now, we talk about Moshe Rabbeinu. I want to bring out this element from a mind-boggling angle. Moshe Rabbeinu had the famous. What we call the chet. The chet, what happened at the rock? What was his aver there? He was what Rashi says that he was told to speak to the rock and he hit the rock. It's important to realize when you just look at the psukim, it's not clear what exactly the accusation against Moshe was. The Ramban, for example, says, no, he was supposed to hit the rock. That was what he was told last time. He was supposed to follow the same process this time too. Ramban has a different approach. It's not clear. And therefore, different Mefarshim go in different directions. I want to tell you what the Rambam says. And this really, for me, was like, whoa, this is who Moshe Rabbeinu was. Meaning, by studying the chet of Moshe Rabbeinu, the so-called chet of Moshe Rabbeinu, we can gain a little bit of an inkling of who he was. The Rambam says like this. There's a few Rishonim who say that the chet, so to speak, was in the way he addressed Klal Yisrael then. Shimon HaAmorim, you rebellious ones. What was the problem there? Okay, so you might say it was a slight expression of anger, but listen where the Rambam takes it. The Rambam says as follows. He says something so mind-boggling. He says Moshe was so transparent, so not there, I mean, so just a reflector of Hashem, this reality of Moshe Rabbeinu was so intense that any word he said you understood was reflecting what's in Hashem. But even more than that, the Rambam says, the Bnei Yisrael looked at Moshe's facial expressions in order to get a sense of where they stood from Hashem. It's mind-boggling. If Moshe Rabbeinu was walking around looking pleased, They sensed that Hashem was pleased with them. They knew that Hashem was happy with them. If Moshe Rabbeinu looked upset, they understood, uh-oh, we're not, there's something disfavorable going on now. Moshe was mamish, the reflector of Hashem. So listen to this Aveira, Halavai, that we could, it says that he was the one instance where Moshe Rabbeinu actually expressed something that Hashem wasn't kibiyachol feeling at the time. There was an expression, a mild expression of anger that didn't reflect Hashem. And it misled the Bnei Yisrael. Hashem was not angry at them at the time. He wasn't displeased by their request. But Moshe expressed a certain displeasure. That, for Moshe Rabbeinu, was what was held against him. Mind-boggling, just in terms of understanding what we're dealing with. And okay, now let's go a couple of steps further. So that is one of the most famous characteristics that we attribute to Moshe Rabbeinu. I think the main two that are stressed are the anova and the transparency, which really are, you know, part and parcel. And the other is the aspect of the Noisa Ba'oil, the ability to really carry the load of Klal Yisrael as in being the ultimate Jewish leader, whose essence is not figuring out what do these people need, not I know best what's good for these people, but rather carrying the oil. Well, let's develop it a bit further. The more we appreciate the transparency of Moshe, the more difficult it becomes to really appreciate, so what was his role? So is it really that, just meaning there's no Moshe here and Hashem is busy conveying his word through Moshe? So there's some more insight that we can get into appreciating the unimaginable responsibility that Moshe carried and what debt we have toward Moshe until this very day in terms of the Torah that we have from Hashem. The Gemara says, it makes a lot of emphasis on, when it talks about Matan Torah, the greatness of the giver, the greatness of the receiver, and the greatness of the middleman, of the one in the middle. Now, we would think, wait a minute, the Torah is the Torah, the Jewish people are the Jewish people. Yes, there was the great Moshe Rabbeinu in between. But would he be called, like, did he really play a role? Obviously, he was not giving it over, but Hashem was giving it over through him. Whatever the word of Hashem was, the word of Hashem was. Where would we say that Moshe's major impact was? Was it because if it wasn't him, nobody else would be able to be the conveyor? But it's very interesting, when you actually study the Parshias, particularly the Parsha of Matan Torah, another very awesome picture emerges. And that is that, no, it wasn't just about, here's the Torah, here's Klal Yisrael, it's going to get together, and just a question of, can you pass it? The Torah, if we'll put it this way, could have been planted in Klal Yisrael to different levels, meaning depending on the way they would receive it. It wasn't just like, Hashem's giving it, it is what it is, you took it, so you got it. No, the more receptive Klal Yisrael was, the more fertile soil they were, the more it would really take root. Which means that theoretically, Chas V'Shalom, there could have been a situation where Klal Yisrael weren't really as receptive as they should have been, which would mean that the roots would have been struck a bit more weak. The Torah in Klal Yisrael would have been rooted more weakly. Moshe's immense responsibility was to be the facilitator, to be the one ensuring that no, Klal Yisrael would be receiving the Torah in the most optimal way possible, so that when the Torah is actually implanted in Klal Yisrael, the roots would strike to the deepest levels. So I'll just give two examples of this, and then we'll move on to the next point. The Bnei Yisrael arrive at Har Sinai. Bnei Yisrael arrive at Har Sinai, and it says, very fascinating to really learn that whole parasha in depth. But basically what happens was, Klal Yisrael, they arrived in a great state of enthusiasm. Like they're very, very anticipating what's going to be happening. And it says they don't even set up camp. They just arrive, they drop everything, and they all head toward Har Sinai. And it says, Moshe Olo El Elikim. As soon as they arrive, Moshe heads right up toward Har Sinai. Vayikra Elikim al Moshe, I don't have the words in front of me right now, but it's the effect of Vayikra Elikim al Moshe min ahar, And then Hashem calls out to him, meaning sequences. They arrive, Moshe immediately goes up to Sinai, and then Hashem calls out to him, and then begins the dialogue. Moshe to Hashem, to Moshe, to Klal Yisrael, back to Hashem, back to Moshe, back to Klal Yisrael, right? Hashem. Moshe is busy conveying the messages back and forth. So we have to appreciate something. Hashem really introduced himself to the Bnei Yisrael when he said, Anochi Hashem Elokeinu. But in the days preceding that, there's conversation, right? There's back and forth. We have to realize that this wasn't just technical. Every time the Bnei Yisrael got a message from Hashem, it was another enhancement of their neshamas. It was making them that much more in position to connect to Hashem. Those few days that they stood at the foot of Har Sinai with the back and forth going on, it was much more than just, well, let's work out the terms. All the back and forth was mamish putting them through, after all the days that they had spent building up to the actual arrival at Har Sinai, from Rosh Chodesh Nisan and on, it was like Hashem was putting them through this power wash, right? Elevating them and purifying them that much more. That was the significance of the back and forth that was going on throughout those days. And that back and forth happened as a result of Moshe's understanding. As soon as he came to the foot of Har Sinai, had he just waited for Hashem to call him, it might have taken another day or two or three. But Moshe said, no, we're coming to be Mekabel the Torah. We are here to show Hashem that we want it, to bring our eagerness out to the fullest. And therefore, Moshe really began the process and got the most out of the process by immediately going up. And the way the Ar HaChaim puts it, the reason Hashem began the communication was a response to that, because Moshe had that understanding. To start the process immediately, the Klal Yisrael got so much more before Matan Torah that when they were much more in position to get the full effect of Matan Torah, again, as a result of Moshe's conscientiousness. What happens? Then Moshe Rabbeinu goes up, Hashem gives his proposal. Moshe Rabbeinu comes down. If you follow the Pesukim carefully, it says that Moshe Rabbeinu approached the Skenim. He came to the elders to give over the word of Hashem, what Hashem had told him. And then it says, and the entire nation answered, it's a little bit of a discrepancy, right? It doesn't look like he's coming back to the whole nation. It looks like he's just coming to this game. The Mefarshim say, try to find the Pesukim, the Mefarshim say that it's true, he wasn't immediately coming down back to the whole people with Hashem's proposal. Why? Because again, this is Moshe carrying that unbelievably heavy responsibility that I'm going to be beaming a proposal from Hashem to Klal Yisrael. If there's any lack of enthusiasm in their response, the consequences are going to be eternal, because that'll be reflected in the level to which they're actually able to get Torah. Moshe was very concerned about that. And therefore, he did not want to go straight back to Klal Yisrael. What he wanted to do was first gather together the Zkenim, consult with them, and say, how can we give this over to Klal Yisrael in a way that we can ensure that they'll get the full effect? But what ended up happening was that as soon as Klal Yisrael, they were in that enthusiastic state, as soon as they saw him starting to confer with the Zkenim, they all, how do you say, automatically, what's the word? Uncoordinated. No, there's a word for it. Forgetting the word. Spontaneously, that's the word. Thank you. They spontaneously all yelled out with the same response. Kol Asher Dibra Hashem Nasa. They're basically telling Moshe, Moshe, no conferences, no figuring anything out. If Hashem said it, we want it. And this was the Nasa V'Nishma, right? See, Nasa V'Nishma is such a central part of Matan Torah, because that's really what it is. If they would have said, okay, they would have gotten the Torah also, but it would have been at a very different level. It wouldn't have taken root in the same way. But again, we're seeing the responsibility that Moshe is carrying to ensure that it's all carried out to the utmost. So this also just again gives us a little tiny peephole into what was Moshe Rabbeinu carrying on his shoulders. And all throughout the 40 years in the Midbar, throughout the 40 years in the Midbar, Moshe's chinuch of the Jewish people, he is carrying the responsibility for the foundation of Torah and Klal Yisrael. And here we come to the next stage of Moshe Rabbeinu's role and what Moshe Rabbeinu did for us. How would you characterize the dynamic between Moshe and the Jewish people throughout the Midbar. What was the mood? Was it pleasant? Was it frustrating? Contentious, contentious. So when you move through the parashas, you see this one incident after another incident after another incident, and it looks like, wow, it was really like it wasn't working. It's frustrating. So that's right. That's number one. But the point that I want to bring out is that actually we have to have the right perspective on what was going on there. Here's how the Alter of Kelm frames it. He says, no, it wasn't anything about, it was not frustration. It wasn't frustration. What was it? He says, Moshe Rabbeinu was the ultimate mechanic. He actually says Hashem. Hashem was the master pedagogue, the very great mechanic. What we saw as frustration actually was something else. Hashem was pushing, or contentiousness, was Hashem pushing his people to the highest of standards. It was an extremely high standard training program. And in a very high standard training program, it's going to be tough. It's going to be demanding. You're not going to hear soft talk. Oh, we've given the mashal a few times. We've given the mashal a few times. If you go to two different army camps, right? We said the mashal here, I think so. Let's say you go to one army camp and you see the commander is sitting around with the guys, they're smoking together, they're drinking together, and they're all having a good time. Okay? And the atmosphere is informal. Okay, that's one army. Then you go to visit a different army camp, a different army, okay, a different army. And what do you see? You see the soldiers are standing in a tight line, and the sergeant is just yelling and yelling at the top of his lungs. If you approach that from a superficial standpoint, you'll say, apparently this sergeant is having a hard time whipping his guys into shape. The other one is happy with his soldiers, right? Apparently, that army is in a better situation. But anybody with a little bit of an understanding understands that no. An army where the sergeant is chilling with the soldiers, you can assume is an army that doesn't really have its act together. And if everything is fine and hunky-dory, they probably don't have their act together. The army where you see that the sergeant is never satisfied, always demanding more, always yelling, that's an army that is aiming for absolute perfection, for top, top, top performance without room for the slightest chink in the perfection of the performance. This is what was going on throughout the 40 years in the Midbar. Hashem was a mechanech, the old-fashioned mechanech. Moshe Rabbeinu was that Rebbe. It was that Rosh Yeshiva, the old-fashioned style. We're not mechanech like that these days. We can't, we shouldn't be, and we can't be. But we're talking about the old material. And this was about chinuch. It was not about not working. Hashem was very pleased, just like Chavis Salava says. You know, the other nations would like to say, Hashem, like the first marriage didn't work out. What does that say about Hashem's judgment of character? That's what the Chavis Salava puts it. Like Hashem couldn't figure that out? We would presume that Hashem is the ultimate, we know that Hashem is the ultimate judge of character, which means that he knew exactly who he wanted for his purposes. And if it was a struggle to get them to the standard, that means that these are the people who Hashem chose. He wanted that. And so why was it a struggle? The reason it was a struggle was twofold. A, because yes, the B'nai Yisrael were a stubborn bunch. And on the contrary, it's like the Sfarim say, if you want to etch something in butter, the butter won't resist. No problem. You can etch whatever initials you want, give you an easy time. Come back 15 minutes later, there's nothing there. You want to etch something in stone, the stone has a lot to say. You're going to get frustrated. It's going to be very frustrating. You may not be able to do it, but if you can do it, once the etching is there, you can come back 1,000 years later, it's still there. These are the people that Hashem wanted. But the truth is that that's only the superficial level. It goes much further than that. And that is that Hashem was training them to supernatural standards, standards that the human being would consider unrealistic. And Hashem is coming and saying, That's from the human perspective of a human being. But I'm the only one who knows the true secrets of human beings' abilities. And I'm telling you that by me driving you and you following my program, I can make out of a human people something unimaginable. And that was the process he was putting them through in the Dora. I mean, Hashem was raising them from the level of humans to the level of true humans. I think we've quoted a couple of times. It was, I'm not sure if it was the Tzemach Tzedek, one of the middle Lubavitcher Rebbes, who was asked, why don't you put a stress on miracle workers, on miracle working, on miracle stories, right? That was very common. All the stories about miracles and wonders, etc. He said, well, apparently in Lubavitch, they put less of a stress on it. And this Rebbe, which was the Tzemach Tzedek, or one of the middle Rebbes, was asked about that. And he said, for us, the greatest miracle we want to display is that you can take a hunk of flesh and turn it into an Adam. Meaning we start out as a hunk of flesh, but then we put ourselves through the process and we actually gain the title of the real Adam. And this is what Hashem was looking to develop. Shlomo, question.
So I might be getting it wrong, but it seems to me when I hear the Parshios, it's like Moshe's complaining to Hashem about the stiff-necked people, and
Ah.
so what's Moshe's role?
What's Moshe's role? So here we got sidetracked. You're right. We're really talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. Where was Moshe Rabbeinu's role here? So Moshe Rabbeinu's role was, we can call it a certain almost conflicting realities. On the one hand, and on the other hand, and on the other, and then on back to the first hand, and back to the second hand, and Moshe Rabbeinu had to be living the whole time. He was that sergeant. He was the man who was meant to be elevating the Bnei Yisrael to those unrealistic levels. This was a task that is beyond the human being. Well, we would think. But this was the task that Moshe was given because of his ability to do it. And he was driven to his capacity, what would he would have thought is beyond his capacity. Mamish, the full capacities of the human being and of the human teacher, the human leader. And he, on the one hand, his role was to be very harsh with the Bnei Yisrael. You barely find a good word from him to the Bnei Yisrael, not because he was frustrated, but because he was the great mechanech. And that's why Avigdor Miller made a very big deal about this. At the end of the 40 years, we have a different source of feedback about the Bnei Yisrael. There's one parsha in the Torah since Shemois that happened that the Bnei Yisrael are completely oblivious to, the parsha of Balak. A whole parsha in the Torah right in the middle that they had no idea that it was going on at the time. And here, again, you have Hashem's feedback about the people. Match that up against everything that Moshe was saying the whole time. It doesn't add up. It's so effusive, so flowering, so loving and affectionate and complimentary, right? How do you match that up against everything Moshe is saying the whole time? The answer is what we're discussing. It's like Hashem was saying, I want my sentiments toward my people to go on record, but chas v'shalom that they should hear it. It'll ruin everything. It'll ruin everything. They have to be hearing from Moshe Rabbeinu banging them over the head. While at the end of the 40 years, Hashem is coming and saying, it sounded so frustrating the whole time. I'm looking at the product of the project and I am unbelievably pleased. This is what Hashem is saying. So Moshe was in that position of being the one who had to be harshly castigating the Bnei Yisrael the whole time. Like, Mamrim, you've been rebelling against Hashem from the day I got to know you. What's Bilam saying? Like, Hashem sees no flaws, nothing wrong with Klal Yisrael. Hashem, just one moment. Hashem, Reyus. He's just dwelling with them in a state of affection. Question.
I always wondered, what's the risk of emotionally up? They're both going up and down, right? They're both in some ways similar. Eliyahu at one point is also ranking up Nisha, and Hashem gets angry and says the mouth in him on the lips.
That was somebody else. That was Yeshayahu. That was Yeshaya. That was Yeshaya. Eliyahu is a different story. Eliyahu was dealing, but he was dealing with the Dor that was doing Averis. You know what? Let's see. Maybe one of these weeks we'll dedicate a shiur to the whole parasha of Eliyahu. But Moshe Rabbeinu was in a very different role from Eliyahu. Moshe Rabbeinu was in the role of laying the foundations of the founding class, so to speak.
That's what he said, but he's
What's that?
supposed to be angry at the whole
So this was the one time, on the contrary, this was the one time when there was a little bit, a hint of his own personal anger. But the fact that that was made into such a big deal, that's what reflects on what the whole reality was the whole time. So that is Moshe Rabbeinu in terms of being the Machanech of the Jewish people. Now, toward Hashem, what's he expressing? Toward the Jewish people, he's expressing all of his complaints against them, all of his criticisms. At the same time, toward Hashem, what's he busy doing? He's mamish working in two conflicting directions. Toward Hashem, he's busy the whole time being melamed zchus. This is also the role of the Jewish leader. The role of the Jewish leader. So, what should a Jewish leader be? Should he be complimentary toward the people? Should he be critical of the people? The answer is that he has to be ready to mamish do both sides of the coin at the same time. Speak out of both sides of his mouth. He has to hold them in high regard and yet give it to them over the head in no uncertain terms. If he doesn't believe in them, he's not going to be able to move them forward. If he is only telling them how great they are, he is not going to move them forward. He'll be popular, yes. He'll be a sought-after rabbi, but he's not going to move them forward. Gemara says that. Sometimes you see a rebbe, everybody loves him. It's because he won't tell it to them to their face. So Moshe Rabbeinu is doing both. Toward Hashem, he's busy saying, look what a great people you have, etc., etc., pointing out all their milas. Toward the Bnei Yisrael, look how far you are from anything good, etc. That's the role that, yeah, the true Jewish leader is caught between. So here we're getting a few inklings of the immense role that Moshe Rabbeinu was playing. And here I just want to turn around and tie it up with what we saw at the end of this last week's parsha. Know the famous Chazal. Now I'll approach it from a more contemporary place. Reb Shlomo Freifeld, Zichrono Livracha, was in his sukkah. His sukkah was lined with pictures of the great pre-war Gedolim from Europe. So some Talmud came in and asked him, who are these people? So he said, these are the members of a race that went extinct, the human race. Doesn't really exist anymore. In other words, what was he saying? It's kind of along the lines that we said. The title of Adam, what is an Adam? Saying, Adam? Look at any person, that's an Adam. He said, no. Adam is something very deep and infinite when you're talking about really living up to and achieving the true title of an Adam. And therefore, it's like he said, we might call ourselves Adam, but then I don't know what we need to call them. The way he put it was, these are true Adams. We don't really have such things anymore. Now, how did the Gemara say it? Right? The Gemara says it. Im rishonim kimalachim, anu kibnei Adam. When you look back at the generations before, well, the relativity is one of two things. Either they're malachim and we're people. I mean, if you want to think of ourselves as people, then they're beyond, they're malachim. Or you can call them people, but then you have to view yourselves, anu kachamayrim. We are donkeys. The point being that you have to realize that you look at a human being, you're seeing flesh and blood, you're seeing the same physical systems across the board. The heart works the same way, the lungs work the same way, the vocal cords work the same way, yet you can be talking about an infinite range of what this bria that you're looking at really is. If you come from the attitude, well, we're all human, it's all basically the same, right? It simply is not true. And this is what Chazal are trying to impress on us. And if we really want to be able to gain the benefit of what we're learning from those who came before us, we have to be able to appreciate this fact. I'll just give you one contemporary example. You know that the whole era of the gadgets, the handheld gadgets, where there's so much going on, it wrecked concentration span, right? I think everybody knows that. It wrecked concentration span. Just talk in very simple terms. Let's talk in very, very simple terms. Today's songs are much shorter than they used to be. If your song used to go on for 3, 4 minutes, now you have a song for about, I don't know, about a minute. Magazine articles, we're not talking Ruchnius now, we're just talking Gashmius. Magazine articles went from 4 or 5 pages to about a page, 2 pages. The concentration span is just shot. You especially when you see kids who grew into it, and it's like you can't concentrate for more. I just know in the world of shiurim, right? The standard for how long a shiur has to be has gone. I'm not that old, but I've seen the time span go down. Shiurim just have to be shorter. So if someone comes from the attitude of, come on, everyone's human, then as far as you're concerned, someone sitting and listening for a shiur for 3 hours is just, nobody ever did it. They didn't do it 100 years ago either, because you can't, there's no such thing as a human being concentrating for more than 25 minutes. Right? That's the attitude, but of come on, everybody's human. Whatever I'm familiar with today must be how it always was, must be how everybody is. When we actually expose yourself to different standards, different realities, you can see that no, what we call human, there's a whole different concept of human. Last week's parsha, we have Aaron and Miriam. Again, you want to be careful. We're not saying what was, we're saying what are we meant to take away from it. Aaron and Miriam had their criticism of Moshe Rabbeinu. But Victor Miller said something very strong. He said, the reason that, and you know, we know Miriam with all of her greatness, which is also above and beyond, that was chosen as the paradigm of Lashon Hara that we're meant to, the model of Lashon Hara that we're meant to keep conscious of. Now, Miriam. Remember what Hashem did to Miriam. So Rav Victor Miller said, why, why was that like the epitome? So he said it was more than plain Lashon Hara. Plain Lashon Hara is not appreciating how dangerous it is to start with another Jew. But he said with Moshe, it was more than that. With Moshe, it was, you see, a great person. You figure, well, he's a human like me. And you don't realize that you're dealing with live electricity that's way above you. It's much, the voltage is much higher than yours. In Aaron and Miriam's cases, he was even more than that. They knew that he was very great. But they said, okay, even as a Navi, we're also Nevi'im. That's actually what they were blamed for. We're also Nevi'im. Nevuah is Nevuah. Nevuah is, again, if we're just taking it simply, Nevuah is Nevuah. We're Nevi'im. He's Nevi'im. Why does he have to be doing these excessive things? And basically, Hashem's response to them was, you're a Navi and he's a Navi. But can you not appreciate that if he's that much closer with me and if I'm talking to him all the time, maybe his sensitivities and maybe the place where he is actually way above you? You should understand that if you know that he is in touch with me much more regularly than you are, and if he's that much closer with me than you are, if you know that, you already have to take a reverent step back and say, I better be careful. I don't necessarily know who I'm talking about, and I realize that I'm dealing with live electricity. So that's how I want to just tie up our discussion. So again, like I said, we tried to get a glimpse through a peephole of the untouchable, of the beyond, with the hope that, as we said, if we can be a little bit wet by the mist or expose ourselves to the immensity of the system that we're in as being a part of the historic Klal Yisrael, Dayenu. Yeah, good to work.